We're doing Pentateuch class. We're on schedule in Leviticus. And I'm going to try not to just talk real fast, but I want to cover some ground today. Because we're picking up with chapter 25. Chapter 25 is fairly lengthy, but I'll skim across. It's introducing or reminding us of the land Sabbath. Okay, which the first few verses is, "Speak to the children of Israel, say, when you come into the land," of course for them it'd be about 40 years after this, "then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 days you shall sow your field, 6 years you'll prune your vineyard, gather its fruit, but in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land. To the Lord you shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. What grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap nor gather the grapes. For it's a year of land Sabbath." So, by the way, if you want to make a reference, this isn't the first time God brings it up. It's introduced in Exodus 23, verses 10 and 11. In those chapters that are called the judgments after the Ten Commandments. So Exodus 23, 10 and 11, it's the idea that, okay, you work your land for 6 years. The seventh year, it gets a year off. The land will lie fallow. Okay, there's a couple reasons for that. One is letting the land rest and letting, you know, grass, crops, whatever, grow up and then just die and go back into the soil can help rejuvenate its fertility. They didn't have chemical fertilizers, and many would say this is much better for the land anyways. Also, there will be what's called volunteers. You know, stuff will grow up on its own. If any of you have ever planted tomatoes, and then you don't plant, or you do anyways, and you see these other plants you didn't. Volunteers is the term around here. I don't know if there are other terms, but it's something that grows on its own that you didn't plant. He makes it clear that this can be for those who are traveling or poor. You're not supposed to go out and reap your field, but if there's wheat or barley that happens to be growing up there on its own during the land Sabbath, someone who happens to be traveling and is hungry can go and pluck some of those ears. Or the poor in your area can do it the same as for gleaning. Okay, so these are two things it accomplishes. It does provide that service for those who don't have land to plant. It helps rejuvenate the soil. And we could add, it is a great test and builder of faith. You know, you had to rely on God to provide enough. Okay, so you've got to trust God that in year six, I'm going to have a bountiful harvest. I'm going to get enough food that I can can it, I can freeze it. I guess they didn't probably freeze much then. But you can dry, you can provide, and it'll last you for 2 years, not just for the 1 year. I think it's interesting, and I'm skimming ahead. This we're covering basically up through verse 7, that when Israel went into the promised land, they all went in at once, they're given their land. So for them, they were keeping the land Sabbath on the same schedule because it was part of really the law of the land, the nation. I'm pointing this out because many in the church today do keep a land Sabbath if they plant a garden or if they're farmers and plant crops, but the whole nation doesn't do it at once. You know, I've done that. I've dug a garden in my backyard, and after 6 years, I let it rest. But the land Sabbath for me might be different than, say, Josh, you know, because he started at a different time. Matter of fact, my in-laws have two huge garden patches, which you wonder, when you're 82 years old, do you need an acre of garden so that you can complain about your kids not coming to help you with it? But the one they started planting as soon as they moved in, the other one they plowed up a couple years later and started doing. So one kept the land Sabbath 2 years earlier than the other. And I don't think that's not a problem. Now, if we were in ancient Israel, there would be a year that's designated the land Sabbath. Now, I'll make the point, and I don't want to get into this. Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time, but we could argue and say this whole land Sabbath idea was part of Israel's civil law. It's a land for that nation, just like the criminal law. Some would say, we don't have to do that. I wouldn't want to get into a knockdown dragout, but I've already mentioned I've kept it because I think the underlying principles are valid and things that are worth us doing, if nothing else, the building and testing of your faith. But you could, you know, I don't want to say that this is a binding eternal spiritual law, but I think the underlying principle of taking care of your land, of sharing and providing for others and trusting to do what God says in faith is eternal abiding. that make sense? I'm not sure. I'm trying not to confuse the matter, but okay. So I want to move ahead. Verses 8 through 10 will introduce something else. It says, verse 8, you shall count seven Sabbaths of years for yourselves, seven times 7 years. How many years is seven times seven? Okay, that's pretty easy, okay? So after 49 years, then in verse 9, you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound. On the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement, you'll make the trumpet sound throughout all your land, and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all of its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee to you. Each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you return to his family. Verse 11, that 50th year shall be a Jubilee to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of the untended vine. It's a year of Jubilee. It'll be holy. So several things are happening, but we see every 50th year, it seems there would be a second land Sabbath. There's going to be two in a row. The 49th year, because it's the 7th year, was a land Sabbath. God is saying, and this is essentially once in a generation. Most people didn't live so long, so you're only going to experience this probably once in your lifetime, at least that you'd be old enough to remember. Me, I'm 50-some years old. Okay, I will have experienced it once. I don't know if I'm going to live another 50 years past that. It's possible. We know Moses lived to 120. So, but what I'm getting at, it's a big deal. And a number of things are going to happen in this. Sorry, I'm thinking there's a number of things I want to introduce. And I'll just point out, I've come across some scholarly works that try to make a case that it's not a second land Sabbath, that all of this is really relating to that 49th year. I'm not convinced by those, but I wanted you to be aware there is that scholarly debate out there. And it's really just academic. Since we're not part of a nation keeping this as our national system, we don't have to worry about it. But, if you ever come across that, you say, oh, that's interesting. Interesting debate for the sake of interesting debate. Okay, in the Jubilee year, we've already said it's a land Sabbath, but some other significant things will happen. One, it's already introduced the idea that land ownership is going to revert to its original families. It said that in verse 10, each of you shall return to his possession. Let's look at verse 13, it says the same thing. Each return to his possession. And in verse 14, it says, if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not oppress one another. Verse 15, and this is specifically referring to land. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy it from your neighbor. And according to the number of years of crops, he shall sell to you. According to the multitude of years, you'll increase its price. According to fewer number of years, you'll diminish its price. This is basically saying that families could not sell their land permanently. Once in a generation, it's going to revert back to the family that owned it. Now, and that would affect the price of the land then. He's saying, okay, the Jubilee is coming up in 45 years. Basically, the person buying land is, you could say, really leasing the land. They're buying 45 years worth of crops, minus the land Sabbath that would come. But if the Jubilee comes in 5 years, you're buying 5 years of crops. That's definitely going to affect the price. Okay, so that's built in. Why in the world would you do something like this? And keep in mind, this is affecting the economic social system for the whole nation. It's not a picky little thing that families deal with. It's how the whole country would run. That's if they ever did it. One main reason is it seems that this would work to prevent excessive buildup of wealth and control of land among a few families. There would never be a feudal system in ancient Israel if they followed this. And if you studied European history, the Middle Ages, basically land ownership was the basis of wealth and political control and military might. And a few families owned all the land and everyone else were peasants or serfs and didn't have any. God said, I don't want it to be that way in my land. Everybody's going to own some land, and even if they get poor and they have to sell it, their children would get it back or their grandchildren. So I think it's really a cool system. Let's mention verse 19. there's a question. No, where is it? Oh, verse 20. If you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow nor gather produce? Verse 21, I'll command my blessing on you in the sixth year. It'll bring produce enough for 3 years. And you'll sow in the eighth year. Basically, God is saying, look, keeping a land Sabbath takes a lot of faith. To keep the Jubilee takes even more. You're saying 2 years, I'm not going to plant anything? What am I going to eat? God is saying, I'm going to make it so that in year 48, you got food just coming out of your ears. You're going to have such a huge increase. You got to trust God for that to happen, but he's saying he'll make it happen. I'm reminiscent of the story of Joseph in Egypt when God showed Pharaoh the dream of the skinny, of the fat cows and then the skinny cows, and basically said, I'm going to make the land super abundant for 7 years. You're going to have food like crazy, but then there'll be 7 years of famine. So during those 7 years, Joseph organized saving the food, storing it up, and was able to feed the nation for 7 years. Now, if they could do that, surely God could provide enough food for 2 years, and 2 years of not even necessarily being famine. So it's kind of a neat system. And God said, I'll make it work. I was going to say something. Maybe I should ask the question. Do you see there's an inherent sadness of how this plays out. I'm not phrasing that very well. So instead of asking you the question, I'll tell you. I think it's really sad that going through the narrative history in the Bible, there's no record of them ever keeping the Jubilee. Now, it's possible they did, but to be honest, for most of Israel's history, they were not obedient to God long enough to have kept a Jubilee. They didn't stay loyal for 50 straight years. The one period where they might have would have been under the reign of David and then Solomon. So it's possible that a Jubilee year or two occurred in there, but it's not recorded that they did. And it's kind of sad. God set up this system that would have been good for everyone, and there's no record of them being obedient long enough to actually put it into practice. Okay, we're not done with explaining the system, though. So verses 23 through 28 bring in the idea of redeeming the land. Say, you know, it's year 38, I'm really down and out, and I gotta get land to feed my family, or I gotta get money. So I sell my land to Kayla, her and her family buy it, okay, you know, and it's going to be, 12 more years till Jubilee comes. But Andrew is my uncle. That's kind of amusing to think, but Andrew has money and he learns that I sold the land, he wants to keep it in the family, he has the right to go to Kayla and say, I want to buy back the land. You know, he is a kinsman redeemer. He's the next near of kin who he has the legal right to buy it. She can't say, no, we signed a contract, I bought it, I'm keeping it. So a kinsman redeemer has the right to buy it back. Now, not just anybody can do it. It has to be somebody, a relatively close family member, usually a brother, you know, a father or a son or an uncle. And the Bible never specifies how far out you can go. Can you go to second cousin, third time removed? I don't know. Now, and by the way, the kinsman redeemer applies to not only land, but can apply to servants and things like that. It's central to the story of Ruth. Many of you are familiar, you know, Ruth, Naomi, and Elimelech sold the land and went away to Moab. When Ruth and Naomi, who's now going by the name Mara, come back, you know, Boaz is willing to buy this land. He's a kinsman redeemer, but there is a kinsman nearer who has the right before them. Anyways, yeah. Just like you would negotiate the price of the land based on how long it is until the Jubilee, if a kinsman redeemer comes along, say I sell in year 38, but Andrew decides to buy back the land in year 45, he doesn't need to buy it back at the same price I sold it. The scripture says you negotiate because the price is going to steadily go down. Basically following, we could say, amortization. Now, Mr. Creech, is that the right, you know, the price varies, you amortize the value, that's a good accounting term, you know, based on the years left. Well, thank you. It's been a long time since I took accounting. So all these things are built in. God, you know, obviously God is smart, and he realized these are principles that should apply. Okay, verses 29 to 34, describe how houses that are within walled cities are not part of the Jubilee system. So the Jubilee system is basically about farmland. So there's a walled city with maybe apartment complexes and stuff like that. I'm exaggerating, but that doesn't count. But houses that are part of the field are part of the Jubilee system. And it goes out of its way to say houses that belong to Levites can always be redeemed. And that makes sense. Remember, the Levites didn't own land, but they had these Levitical towns assigned to them. And the Levites weren't supposed to have large walled cities. They're spread out among the people. Okay, so stopping there, because now we're going to move on to another important thing about the Jubilee. Oh, yeah. The Jubilee system would cover three things. Okay, one is return of land. Two is freeing servants. I've got this in there. I want to make sure I'm doing this in the correct order. Yeah, verses 35 to 55 deal with that. And it's bringing up a principle that was also described in the judgments that God gave shortly after the Ten Commandments. In Exodus chapter 21, verses 2 through 6, God basically said, an Israelite, if he gets poor or he commits a crime and he's sold as a slave, can only be a slave for how long? You guys remember? You said 7 years. Somebody else said, somebody say eight? Do I hear nine? Now, basically, 6 years, and then the seventh can go free. Now, the Hebrew, I believe, leaves room to debate whether it's 7 years and then free in the seventh year. But the matching the land Sabbath, which it's not necessarily tied to the land Sabbath, but it is going to be tied to the Jubilee year in a sense. Okay, so anyways, you know, a Hebrew servant could, you know, serve so long and then had to be freed. Now, there it says, but if he comes in, say, I sell myself to my Uncle Andrew here, and he says, Frank, it's sad that you're alone. I'm going to give you a wife, and you can be married and have children. Then the 6 year comes up. He gave me those. They belong to him. I can go free, but they can't. So he could say, Frank, it's sad you're alone. I want to give you a wife. No, I'm going to wait till I'm free, because then my wife belongs to me, not to you. Okay, that's built into that system. Now, there's also the possibility in that system, okay, 7 year, he says, see ya, Frank, I'm done with you. And I say, oh, Andrew, I love being your servant. I don't want to go. What happens then? Do I have to leave anyways, or is there a way for me to continue? I can stay. Thank you. Only it's not just the kindness of your heart. It's built into the law. If I want to become a permanent servant, how do we show that? Yeah, they take me to the doorpost and make a hole in my ear. And it's implied probably wearing an earring to show I'm a permanent servant. Okay, now let's come to the Jubilee year. Here, the Jubilee says that is also a freeing of servants. And although there's some room to debate, it seems to be pretty clear, and I'm convinced that even if I had my ear bored through and I say, I'm going to be your servant forever, when the Jubilee comes, I can still walk. And even if he gave me a wife and I have children that belong to him, they can come with me when the Jubilee comes. So whether or not I accept his offer of giving me a wife might depend on, in the Jubilee system, is it year 12 or is it year 48? If it's year 48, give me that wife because she's going with me in a couple of years. Do you understand? So the Jubilee system returns land. It allows servants to be freed. Andrew.
Can they at any time decide if they want to go? If they're just, they make a big turn and they start being bad?
That's a good question. So I get my ear bored through, but 3 years later I say, yeah, now I do want to be free. The scripture doesn't really address that. It's a good question. I'm afraid I don't have a good answer. The answer I have is I don't know for sure. Yeah, I could see. And it's some people don't want the stress of having to take care of themselves and make their own decisions. I'm not one of those people, but I could see there are people in the world still today. So I don't know. I mean, the scripture doesn't say that he could not be if both parties would agree to it. So I still would have to say I don't know for sure. Yeah. Since it was given to the whole nation at a time, this was a set schedule. That's why it talks about the amortization. The Jubilee is going to come when it comes. And it might be soon, it might be a long time. It's a set year. So once they come into the Promised Land, which at this point they're not in the Promised Land, they're sitting by Mount Sinai, but he says, when you come in, you're going to start counting. Andrew?
And so that begs the question, so if, say it's the 48th year, and someone does a crime or something and becomes a servant, then are they let go of the Jubilee year?
Yeah. So, which brings to mind, you know, now let's look in verse 40. Now, actually, let's go back a little earlier. I wanted to look in verse 35. If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner that he may live with you. Take no usury from your or interest from him, but fear your God. You shall not lend to him for money. I'm the Lord your God. I'm looking for another place where it addresses... because I wanted to introduce the idea that, okay, someone needs help, you help them out. And if, okay, well, because the other thing that's coming up, number three, is there's going to be basically the forgiveness of debts. And this is where this comes into play. The question brought it to my mind. Yeah, and by the way, this whole, I've got some notes here about the whole idea of redemption, the kinsman redeemer. You can draw a strong spiritual parallel to spiritually our lives being sold and forfeit to death because of our sin, but Christ is called a kinsman redeemer. He redeemed us with his blood. And I'd be surprised if you hadn't heard a sermon addressing that issue at some point in your lives or will in the future. And guys, if you have not, write one and make sure you give it sometime in the future. It's a worthy subject. You know, each of us has earned our death. The analogy of the Jubilee says we still can have our life because we have a kinsman redeemer. Yeah, I was thinking Romans 7:14 says we're all sold under sin. Ephesians 1:7, just to complete some of this, in him, that is in Christ, we have redemption through his blood. That is the forgiveness of sin. Okay, the other thing I'm looking for is, primarily applying to people, but the idea is also forgiving debts. A debt could be forgiven at the Jubilee year. So one of the principle comes up is, and I'm looking for the scripture, my eyes not falling on it, and I want to move on to cover some other ground, but here, say that the tide is turned. You know, I used to serve Andrew, but now I'm rich and doing well, and he's falling in hard times. He comes and asks, hey, could I get a loan? And I say, huh, it's year 48. If I make him a loan, if he doesn't pay it back in 2 years, I'm just out. And I said, sorry, no can do, Kemosabe. Not gonna. God specifically says, don't do it that way. And moreover, a lot of times you'll say, don't even think about the interest or money. Just if you can afford to help someone out, it's always better just make it a gift rather than a loan. And I'm coming short on this because, as I said, I want you to understand there's this system that God set to help the people and to run the land. It doesn't apply in the same way to us, but the spiritual principles do. And that includes, you know, lending for interest. We see that making money on an investment is not a sin. But if, you know, say Craig forgot to bring money for lunch, he says, hey, can you loan me $5? And I say, well, I'll give you $5 today if you give me back $7 tomorrow. That's just not Christian. And moreover, the idea is, Frank, if you're awash in cash, just hand him $5 and say, don't worry about it. Help someone else sometime later. That would be the spirit of what God intends. You know, and if I really don't have it, I'd say, well, I'm sorry, I really wish I could, but, you know, it's not a matter of interest. Yeah, Kayla?
In Deuteronomy 15:9, beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying in the seventh year the year of release is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother.
There it is, Deuteronomy 15:9. So I was looking for it here. Now, it was Deuteronomy 15:9 where it says, don't let your eye be evil. I remembered that particular phrase. Yes, Kayla.
In what verse does it say about that the land didn't keep its land Sabbath, and that's why it went into captivity? Is that in which prophet?
I believe that's in Ezekiel, where it basically says, then the land will be allowed to keep its Sabbath when it lies fallow. Yeah, that is, and I'm sorry, I don't have that in here. But that supports the idea that Israel apparently never did, well, never kept the Jubilee. We're not sure about the land Sabbath. Okay, so unless anybody has more questions about Jubilee or land Sabbath, I want to move to Leviticus 26. This is one of the two blessings and cursings chapters. In your mind, you want to tie Leviticus 26 with Deuteronomy 28. And the fact that we count by twos makes that a little easier, except they're two separate books. And I consider these to be an example of what I like to call cause and effect prophecy. It's not in the latter days, this empire is going to destroy that empire. It's basically, if you act this way, this will be what happens. And if you act that other way, this other thing will be what happens. And that's, you know, that's what happens. If you do one thing, blessings. And this is for the whole nation. Now, it begins by reminding them, don't make idols. Don't make idols, carved image, sacred pillar. I'm the Lord. Verse 2, you keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. So God starts off reminding them not to do what we sometimes call the two great sins that God Israel put into captivity. I've got a reference to Ezekiel 18, verses 18 through 24. Ezekiel 18, 18 through 24 says these are the two big things for which Israel was sent into captivity, idolatry and breaking the Sabbath. Here God says, don't do those things. And then he pauses in verse 3, he starts saying, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments, then follow blessings. Rain in due season, the land will yield its produce, your threshing will last to the vintage till sowing, you'll eat bread to the full, dwell in your land in safety. I'll give peace in the land. No one will make you afraid. I'll rid the land of evil beasts. The sword won't go through the land. You'll chase your enemies. All these are wonderful, fabulous things. And I'm not going to read through all of it, but we could remember these mirror the promises God gave first to Abraham, then renewed to Isaac and Jacob. So the blessings that God promised here, he says, if you obey me, I'm going to open the heaven and pour out a blessing, to look back to ahead to Malachi. And we see when God was promising these things to Abraham, a couple of places seem to imply that he made those promises unconditional. Particularly, I've got Genesis 22, 16, where God says, I swear by myself, in blessing I will bless you. The reason I'm pointing that out is, okay, God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob unconditional. Here we see conditions. How do we reconcile that? Well, I'll show one way that I think we'll reconcile, and it partly has to do with, you know, these are blessings long-term on a nation. God promises these blessings, promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob they would happen. He didn't say exactly when or for how long, and that's something to consider. Let's move ahead to verse 14. We see the other side of the coin. If you do not obey me, do not observe these commandments, despise my statutes, verse 16, I'll do this to you. Okay, here's what happens. Cause and effect. I'll appoint terror over you, wasting disease, fear. You'll sow your seed in vain. Your enemies will eat it. My face will be set against you. You'll be defeated by your enemies. And verse 18 says an interesting phrase. If after all this you do not obey me, I'll punish you seven times more for your sins. Okay, it's worth knowing that phrase. Seven times more. The Hebrew there, if I have it correctly, is Shiba, which is related to the year for seven. Shiba Yasaf. Y-A-S-A-F is how I have it transliterated. Yasaf means to increase or to do again. It could also be translated. So seven times, well, okay, seven times means seven times, and then more. So it implies an increased intensity or magnitude of punishment, which what he said already doesn't sound so great, so doing it even seven times more definitely doesn't sound good. And we see that. Verse 19, your strength will be spent in vain. Your land won't yield its produce. Verse 21, if you walk contrary to me, and I'll walk contrary to you. I'll bring on you seven times more plagues. Once again, Sheba Yasaf. Seven times with greater intensity. Now let's, verse 21, also greater intensity. Verse 22, I'll send wild beasts among you. They'll rob your children, destroy your livestock. Verse 23, if by these things you're not reformed by me, but walk contrary to me, I'll walk contrary to you. I will punish you yet seven times for your sins. Interesting, it has seven times, but Yasaf is not there. Is that a big deal? Does that matter? Well, possibly. And I wanted to explain this because this comes up, and actually it's already come up in the book of Daniel. And every year, Mr. McNeely covers Daniel before I get to this. And he asked me, have you talked about the seven times? So we're getting there. But you remember with Nebuchadnezzar, he's made like a beast for seven times or 7 years. Okay, and you translate that into... Not only did we talk about Nebuchadnezzar seeming like a beast for seven literal years, but he also said if you do a day for a year principle, you come up with 2,520 years. And they looked at how Babylon fell and was not a power for, we could calculate 2,520 years, and he looked ahead to perhaps the coming together of Europe. Do you guys remember him discussing that? And the Pope, whichever one it was, making this edict about how Europe should find its roots. I'm just telling you this to remind you of the principles we went through here, because perhaps that's what applies here. And I wrote some stuff ahead of time, because he introduced the idea that if we say seven times, a time often is portrayed as a year. As in Revelation 12, 14, the end time, there's time, times, and half a time. And it becomes evident that it means 3.5 years. So I wrote this, so I don't know if you guys can read it. Revelation 11, verse 3 also references the 3.5 years and equates it to 1,260 days. And another place in Revelation 13, 5 refers to 42 months. So there's three different ways to say 3.5 years. One is time times and half a time, or just 3.5 years. Another is 1,260 days. Another one is 42 months. The important thing is, if we're making these equivalents, then we have to say a month is exactly this long. 30-day months. I think we're doing 30-day months. I didn't write that down. And it comes out to years of 360 days. The reason I'm stressing this and going through it is, if you look at a Jewish calendar, you say, well, some months are longer than others, and some years are longer than others because of the intercalary months. And that's why some years the feast is real early and some years it's real late. But it all works out over a 19-year cycle. Okay, so we understand the calendar has these variations that balance in the long run. But what we seem to see where God breaks it down is when we're dealing with prophecy, he doesn't include leap years. He just says, okay, so many years, we could say that, and they are all averaged to 360 days for each of those years. So I'm doing a lot of rigmarole to get to that point. And I wanted to cite the scripture so you don't think, oh, he's just making that up for convenience. I'm not above making something up for convenience. I'm happy to do it when I can get away with it. Yes, Julie. It depends on how seriously you want to discuss these things with people. I want you to know that what this is going to boil down to is seven times or 7 years if we apply the day for a year principle, which we see enumerated in Numbers 14:34 and also Ezekiel 4 verses 5 and 6. Because seven times, if each one of these times is 360 days, comes out to 2,520. And you do want to know, because on the test there's a question, it's like, what's this about 2,520 years? So I want you to understand that's why it's tied to. I think on the review sheet I gave you, I asked, how does this apply to what's in Leviticus 26? Because what I'm going to come down to, if earlier that seven times more was referring to an increase in intensity, But now he just says seven times, but he's not referring to intensity. He could be referring to just passage of time. I'll punish you seven times. I promised Abraham the blessings are going to come. I swore by myself. It's irrevocable. It's unconditional. But I might remove them for a set period of time, and then I will fulfill my unconditional promise. And that set time, if this is referring to prophecy, could be 2,520 years. So maybe there's a 2,520-year delay in the blessings of Abraham on the children of Israel. And I'm saying maybe. There are some people in God's church who I trust and respect who would say, yeah, this is wishful thinking. But there are a lot of people who say, no, it seems to fit. We can think of it, some of the numbers. We see some what I call correspondence. When did Israel stop enjoying blessings that God promised? Say the northern kingdom that had the name Israel. What happened to them? I think we know, right? Kayla?
Captive by the Assyrians.
Okay, they were taken captive. The Assyrians invaded the land, started taking them away. This began in the 730s BC. So, and I say 730s because, yeah, Samaria fell and the conquest finished at a set time, but it was going on for years before that. So if we go count from about the decade of the 730s forward, 2,520 years, we come to the 1780s. Was that very significant? Oh, I don't know, as an American historian who studies the Revolutionary War period, I'd say yes, the United States became independent and would go on to become the most powerful, wealthy nation that ever existed. If we count from exactly 721 BC, which is the date that is commonly accepted for Israel's fall, count forward 2,520 years, keep in mind there's no year designated zero, you come to the year 1800. Now, I want to be picky and say, okay, what battle happened in 1800? And I've never bothered to look up, but I know it was in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars. And from my perspective, having nothing to do with Bible prophecy, I focused on that period of history, and it's dominated by the struggle between France and Britain, the Empire of France and the Empire of Britain. And they go back and forth. Which is going to be the dominant? Which is going to become the most powerful nation in the world? Well, basically, with especially the Battle of Trafalgar, when France's navy is finally defeated, it becomes evident that it's going to be Britain. It's not concluded till 1815 when Napoleon is defeated for the second time, but it actually comes considerably sooner. I'm trying to think before Napoleon, it was they fought because France helped America, and about 1789, they're put on the shelf, they start fighting again. But in essence, if we count forward from the fall of Samaria, we come to 1800, suddenly Britain becomes the most powerful nation in the world. And America is well on its way, the most powerful empire. It would be the wealthiest. Its wealth and power will last longer than America's has so far. That's why we tend to think in prophecy, Britain is Ephraim, the younger brother who was truly greater. As an American, that grates on me. No, we're better. Well, if you want to be honest in history, the British Empire was greater and still in some ways is. I don't know if that makes James happy. He's part of the empire. You know, still have the queen on your money or did that go away? Okay, no queen anymore. Okay, so maybe this seems to fit. I'll punish you seven times. God punished Israel. They went into captivity and without them knowing it, if this is true, 2,520 years later, blessings are poured out. And if you follow history, you see this rapid rise. I've been watching, there is a dramatic portrayal of Queen Victoria being done on PBS, which is cool. I like to talk to Clint Porter. He and Joy are into it. It's really well done. And you see the Victorian era, it's like, wow, it's amazing that the wealth and power they had. So I don't know, you need to be aware of this. Whether you're convinced of it or not, you need to be aware of it within the church. And that's why I'm spending the time on it. The rest of this goes on to talk about bad things happen. Verse 27, after all this you do not obey me, but walk contrary, I'll walk contrary to you in fury. I'll even chastise you seven times for your son. You'll eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters. I've mentioned before that did happen. during sieges of Jerusalem. There is at least one description of it happening in the Bible. Josephus describes it when the Romans besieged Israel. So Israelites brought terrible punishment on themselves. And some of these descriptions might even be applying to the end time with things that could be brought about by weapons of mass destruction. If we go to verse 42, it said, then, after all, well, actually, verse 40, but if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers and their unfaithfulness in which they were unfaithful to me, that I've walked contrary to them and have brought them to the land of their enemies, if their uncircumcised hearts are humbled and they accept their guilt, then I'll remember my covenant with Jacob and my covenant with Isaac, my covenant with Abraham. I'll remember the land. Oh, Kayla, here's another place. I was thinking about Ezekiel, but verse 43, the land shall be left empty by them and will enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. They will accept their guilt because they're despised. Verse 44, yet for all that, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, nor shall I utterly abhor them. You know what I should have brought to class, right? Here's the example of the great yet I. After all this punishment and being left, God says, I'd never forget. God's love is unfailing. It's still there. And verse 45, but for their sake I will remember the covenant of their ancestors whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Eternal. Powerful chapter. I'm sad that I'm skimming across it, but I'm not sure if me reading it, you know, I've took some time to point out certain things that are worth looking at. I encourage you all to go back and read it again in privacy and think about what it's saying. And God's love, but also his disappointment, his punishment, his unfailing love and determination to still redeem his people. Okay, I got 5 minutes to cover chapter 27. Which I have to say, I wish 26 had been the end and 27 had been moved earlier, because it's kind of anticlimactic. It's dealing with vows. So I don't know if Moses, you know, he ran out of paper or put in a different arrangement. Like I said, I wish this had been after 25 and before 26. And we see in verse 2, speak to the children of Israel and say, when a man consecrates by a vow certain persons to the Lord according to your evaluation, if the evaluation is a male, 20 years old, female, it's going to talk about making a vow. What is a vow? It's a promise, but it's a particular kind of promise. Okay, I say it's a religious promise made to God. Now, Jesus Christ told us not to make vows because we can't turn our hair white or black. And I can attest that. I've dyed my whiskers black and they turn back white again. Julie? This is my own definition, but I call it a religious promise made to God. In our society, we take basically two vows or promises. Now, even though Christ said don't take vows, when we marry, we promise. We take a vow between our partner and God. It's a three-way covenant. And when we're baptized, we take a vow that we're joining to, you know, the body of Christ and serving God. Now, in the Old Testament, there wasn't a forbidding of taking vows. They did say, be careful. Solomon wrote, it's better not to vow than vow and not pay. But when you make a vow, you pay it. This is discussing, though, the idea that sometime you might need to redeem your vow, or you might want to. Now, the vow, besides, we talked about marriage and baptism, a vow could be, I'm promising to abstain from certain behavior. I'm not going to do this, God. Or it might be a promise to do something. It could be a promise to give God something. Remember the story of the judge who promised he'd sacrifice whatever came out of his house first, and it was his daughter? Jephthah, yeah. Okay, he made a vow, stupid vow, or at least not a very wise one, but, you know, so you can vow something like that. And of course, later we'll talk about the Nazarite vows, one particular. And this is referring to vow, you know, dedicating people or property to God. You could give God things, and it could include, remember, I'm Andrew's servant. He could say, I vow to God, I'm going to give my servant to serve at the temple. Oh, thanks a lot, Andrew. But now he made a vow. God is going to say there's a certain valuation, though, if you want to redeem that, or you want to know what it's worth in money. And there's several verses here just breaking it down. I mean, it's differentiated from male and female and by age. This is not something you need to memorize, but in the prime of life, between 20 and 60, years of age, a man was valued at 50 shekels. A woman in her prime from 20 to 60 was valued at 30 shekels. Why? Aren't we equal? What about the Equal Rights Amendment? And now, it's based on basically a system of physical labor. It's not spiritual worth or character worth. It's how much can you do. And men were bigger, faster, stronger, so they had a higher value. And it goes through. Now, young men, at from age 5 to 20, men were only worth 20 shekels and girls worth 10. From 1 month up to 5 years old, men 5 shekels, women 3 shekels. When you get old, you're not worth as much. After age 60, man's value suddenly drops from 50 shekels down to 15, and a woman's from 30 shekels down to 10. Okay, so basically this is laying it out in a system where you might have made a vow and have a reason to redeem the person. And it's saying, okay, here's how you value it, or if you want to make a trade or something like that. Let me summarize. What about animals? Now, we've been talking about people. Well, for one thing, verses 9 and 10 say an animal that could be sacrificed could not be redeemed or traded. Basically, you devote it to God, it's sacrificed, it's done. But unclean animals that could be redeemed, like say I vow I'm going to give to God a donkey. Here, God, you want a donkey? And, you know, the priest might have good use for a donkey hauling stuff around. Later, my son says, I love that donkey. How could you have given that to God? I need it back. Well, I can get it back, but I have to add 20%. Okay, the donkey was worth $25. Oh, I should have done a round number. Say $20. What's 20% of $20? That's $10 would be $4. Okay, so I got to buy him back for $24. So there's a principle. You can do it, but there's a price. Verses 26 and 27 mention the firstborn of clean animals you can't give as a vow. And the reason for that is back in Exodus 13, verse 2, God claimed the firstborn already belonged to him. I can't make a promise to God to give something that's already his. So he's saying just a reminder there. Okay, I want to just cover towards the end. Verses 28 and 29 can be a little confusing. So nevertheless, no devoted offering that a man may devote to the Lord of all that he has, both man and beast of the field of his possession, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted offering is most holy. No person under the ban who may become doomed to destruction among the men shall be redeemed, but put to death. And from what I've read, scholars in the Hebrew still have some trouble. Basically, it says, you know, you can't redeem a person or a thing for the purpose of selling it later. Say I devoted my donkey. I don't know why I'm pointing at Andrew now. But I'm saying he's in the priest, he's at the tabernacle. I make a vow, I devote this donkey, and later I find out it's a purebred that's worth tons of money for breeding rights. I want to get it back so I can make all that money. God says, uh-uh. You can't do it for the purpose of selling it. If my son loved it and it's sentimental reasons, I can do it, but not for selling. Does that make sense? Again, this is something that we're not going to encounter in our day-to-day life. That's one of the reasons I'm skimming it over fairly quickly. The last part, verses 30 to 33, deal with tithes. You know, the tithes belong to God, he says. He's given them to the Levites for their use. So animals that are tithed could not be redeemed. Okay, every tenth one passes under the rod, belongs to God. But apparently crops could be redeemed if you pay the 20%. So, you know, if I had a certain, I gave 10% of my wheat crop, but I want some of that back, I could buy it back for the value of the wheat plus 20%. Does that make sense? Why you might want to do that, I don't know. But I want to address something that's come up in the church, though, that is often misunderstood. Because some people said, well, tithes, I've got a bunch of tithes sitting in my bank account at Second Tithe. Can I borrow that and then pay back 20% later? That's not what this is talking about. It does not mean that. Let me give you an example that would apply. Say, you know, I've had gardens where I've raised tomatoes. Say I'm living at home. This is before I'm in the ministry. I raise $100 worth of tomatoes. And I like, so I'm going to give $10 worth of tomatoes to my local pastor. But what if I say, man, I love these tomatoes. Can I eat the tomatoes instead, give him $10? And the answer is yes, but you got to give him $12. If you want to redeem those tomatoes so you have them for yourself, you have to add 20% value. So I can, if I just love those tomatoes and I know my pastor's not going to appreciate the fine quality of those tomatoes, he'll be happy to have $10 worth of money instead of $10 worth of tomatoes, but in redeeming them, I add 20%. Okay, I would apply that principle to myself because I'm that way. You could say, still, this is part of this national system, the ritual, all that, but to me, if I ever have any doubt if I should apply it or not, I do. And that's, I think, a good guideline. Any questions?